women's liberation and have been for quite a few years now. Over here we have Joan Campana, who is the cross-country coordinator for the Canadian Women's Coalition to Repeal the Abortion Laws. And she, at the present time, is on a cross-country tour speaking for the coalition, and she's just come from a women's liberation conference in Minneapolis. And so she will be giving you the latest details on the U.S. Supreme Court decision on abortion in the States and what's happening with the Canadian Women's Coalition right across the country. And on this side here, we have Carol Sayer, who's a daycare activist, and she's presently working on it with some other women on a daycare handbook. And she's also been involved in the daycare occupation that is going on still right at this moment here in Vancouver at the new government daycare center. And over there, we have DJ O'Donnell, who has also been involved in the women's liberation for several years here in movement here in Vancouver. She's with the Working Women's Association and is also an active member of the IWA Local 217. So I guess we can start out with Joan first. Each speaker has approximately 50 minutes to speak, and when they've all finished speaking, I will then take questions and discussion from the floor.
Okay. On January 22nd, women in the United States won a powerful and fiercely fought out victory for our sex. I'm referring here to the decision of the United States Supreme Court when on that day 7 of 9 judges in the U.S. Supreme Court brought down a decision legalizing abortion throughout the United States. The ruling overturned restrictive and anti-abortion laws in 46 states. The decision said that guaranteed under the Constitution of the United States, and it appealed to the 14th Amendment, which talks about human freedom, human liberty, that abortion was to be a personal decision between a woman and her doctor. There was a wave of jubilation throughout the United States. I don't know how many of you have heard of some of the fierce battles that had emerged over the last year in the United States in law court after law court. In many states across the country, there were very, very heated battles shaping up. One of the most heated was in New York State itself, where the question was again in front of the legislature there. So it was a week of tremendous celebration in the United States. Time magazine itself called the victory a stunning approval for abortion. Women and doctors who a day before were considered common criminals for having or doing abortions were now free human beings merely exercising their inalienable rights under the Constitution of the United States. When you look at the basis of the decision, it becomes even clearer why it was described as a very big victory for women's rights and for the feminist movement. The two major premises of the decision, first one was a woman's right to privacy, or as we have phrased it in the abortion repeal movement, both in the United States and in Canada, a woman's right to choose whether or not to bear a child, to not be a forced breeder, but to have some control over her bodily functions and over her future as a woman. The other side of the United States Supreme Court decision referred very directly to the fact that, in their opinion, a fetus was not a human being. It's just the other side of the coin. A woman is, and she should have the right to control her body and to have the decisive say in this over this question. So the question was raised right away, both in the United States, where I work in the central office of the coalition in Toronto, and in the United States. What brought it about? There's been a long, hard battle, but what happened? And that sort of comes into the topic of the talk tonight on strategies. I don't think it was because the judges were pro-women's liberation. They were 7 older men. I don't think it's just the fact that they woke up feeling good that morning. The legal battle, as a matter of fact, had taken 2 sittings of the Supreme Court. The session before, they had not come down with a ruling. They had waited for the outcome of the elections in the United States, for instance. But I do think that there was a powerful, more important factor that has emerged in the last few years in the United States that's causing waves throughout the United States, and which neither the U.S. Supreme Court nor just about anyone else in the United States could ignore, And that was the power of the emerging feminist sentiment in the United States, which was beginning to delve into and to start talking about for the first time for at least a century, the rights and the needs of women. The women's liberation movement in the United States was becoming more united than ever around the question of abortion, and had in fact chosen to stand and fight on this problem in the United States. Spearheading the struggle in the United States was the Women's National Abortion Action Coalition, which I've worked very closely with. I'll call them WONAC, because I'm going to refer to them a couple of times. They had, in conjunction with a number of other women's groups throughout the United States, organized a series of demonstrations, teach-ins, rallies, court cases that they brought out, speak-outs, a tremendously wide-ranging variety of activities that were mounting more and more pressure on the United States government to finally act on this question. For instance, there was a press conference that I attended in the United States about a week before the final decision came down, and it was attended by a very wide variety of people, and it shows, I think, the breadth of support that had come in behind the whole campaign for repeal of the abortion laws. There was Congresswoman Bella Abzug from New York State was there, Betty Friedan was there, Kate Millett was there, Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's a black woman commissioner of the New York Commission of Human Rights, Gloria Steinem was there, and a whole number of women trade unionists, lawyers, doctors, including male supporters of the campaign. And I think it really showed the breadth and the kind of support that was coming behind the struggle in the United States. As well, a majority of the polls and the media coverage across the country had showed more and more that a growing majority supported a woman's right to choose. I've just returned from, as the moderator tonight referred to, I've just returned from a very big women's liberation conference in Minneapolis. And one of the national coordinators of WONAC spoke at that conference on how the victory with the abortion decision vindicated their method of struggle, their organizing, the largest, most broad, and most powerful number of people behind a woman's right to abortion. She talked, for instance, of how the victory in the United States had to be protected now, how they could see that there was going to be some problems in having the decision implemented uniformly across the United States, although the law itself is very clear in this regard. The right to life forces, as they call themselves, those are the forces that are against a woman's right to choose to have an abortion. Are organizing right across the United States. They've held a number of demonstrations. There have been some more reactionary state legislators who have announced that they will do everything possible to obstruct the right of women to get abortions in the states. And so she talked about vigilance on the part of the women's movement in face of the victory. But she felt that just like their strategy had overturned those rotten laws that have caused women so much suffering for so long, that they would ensure the implementation of the laws. The next question we had to ask ourselves is, what does it mean for Canadian women? What does it mean for us here? Every week in Canada, a panel of three or more faceless strangers sits down in judgment over a number of women's futures. It's in effect a trial at which the woman has no right to appear, and a trial at which the woman has no right of appeal afterwards. This body is called a Therapeutic Abortion Board. It's one of the provisions in the Canadian abortion law, which in my opinion is undemocratic, inhuman, and unworkable. As you probably know, the Canadian law was so-called liberalized in 1969. Eleanor Pellrine, who's a woman, a feminist, and an author, has written a book on abortion in Canada, and she calls the 1969 liberalization the reform that hardly was. Abortion in Canada is in the criminal code. A woman seeking an abortion in general is regarded a criminal. It is a myth in Canada that we have liberal abortion laws, although they're implemented unevenly across the country. One of the test cases in the United States that was decisive in striking down all the anti-abortion laws there was based on Georgia law, which had an almost parallel law to the Canadian one, which included hospital abortion committees, therapeutic abortion committees. In Canada, abortions are illegal except for certain provisions. I'm not going to go into these. If anyone wants to ask questions on them, I'd be very happy to ask for them. Canadian laws do not work. Therapeutic abortion committees don't work. The provisions of the law are enforced, as I said, not uniformly at all across the country. They are particularly hard on poor women or women who live in rural areas. And they have caused women of Canada untold suffering, degradation, and hardship, not to mention death. There's an estimated 100,000 illegal abortions still performed annually in Canada, even after the liberalized law. They are inhuman, unjust, and unworkable, the Canadian laws on abortion. In my opinion, and in the opinion of the Canadian Women's Coalition, they are a major barrier standing in the way of women's freedom in Canada. They place a cloud of uncertainty and criminality over a woman's right to control her body. In our opinion, they must go. We hold the Canadian government responsible for this law. Another question that's come up since the U.S. ruling was how have the Canadian government reacted to the U.S. decision and to the campaign that the abortion repeal forces have launched for a number of years now. What we've got to say is that they've shown hostility and contempt for women and our needs. They've felt under heat because of the United States Supreme Court decision. Grace McGuinness raised it in Parliament the day after the decision by the Supreme Court, and Otto Lang, who is our Justice Minister here, said that in his opinion, he saw no need to carry a debate in the House, even though they promised a debate on this question for over 2 years, and he saw no need to touch the laws. My reaction was perhaps if Otto Lang was a woman facing an unwanted pregnancy or standing outside a hospital abortion board, he might feel the need for it. I think the government of Canada has shown casual indifference to the needs of women on this question. Canadian women now have been responding around this question for a number of years. They've been responding in a very organized fashion in the last couple of years. We are calling on the government, the Canadian government, particularly in light of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, to act now and to repeal the laws. We feel that the majority is on our side. The recent Gallup poll, for instance, was held that showed that 61% of Canadians favored liberalization of the Canadian abortion law. Last year, referendum on 17 campuses across the country saw an average vote of about 75% in favor of repeal. I remember the one here at UBC, was 80.5% in favor of repeal of the abortion laws, and it went like that across the country. The latest McLean's editorial calls for repeal of the abortion laws. I think the question that's posed now is, will the Canadian government deny women in our country human rights that have been won by women in the United States? And I think they're on the spot to reply. But it's more than that. It's more than a question of expectation. I think what we've got to have is a strategy for winning, not just sort of sitting around and leaving it in the laps of the Canadian government or in the hands of the anti-abortion forces, because I know that they're not going to be silent. I looked in today's UBC when I came back on campus today after being away for quite a while, and I can't find it right now, I saw this little ad that said something about abortion is murder, will you join our club to stop it. I just want to say something about that. We in the Canadian Women's Coalition do not have the stand that women should be forced to have abortions. We are saying that women have the right to choose in this question. The people who believe that abortion is some sort of crime, I think, are entitled to their opinions, but I think that they must not, under any circumstances, force their opinions on a majority of Canadians and on a majority of Canadian women. Abortion laws have never killed a living child, but the present Canadian abortion laws have killed women. And I think that is the fact that we cannot ignore. We will never force women who hold the opposite point of view to have abortions. We would defend their right not to have one. But we ask that they do the same in turn to us. I think that we've begun to work out a strategy for winning in the abortion repeal movement. I think that we've learned a lot from the other struggles of the feminist movement. I've been involved in everything from childcare sit-ins at the University of Toronto several years ago to equal pay demonstrations and picket lines. And I think that it's all come together in many ways, and we've begun to learn that you've got to have, above all, a strategy that can involve a large number of people, that can get involved in direct action around the source of our problems as women. I think in our case, the question of abortion law repeal, as in so many, we come smack up against the Canadian government and the law courts and those institutions that in many ways institutionalize women's secondary status in Canada. I think that our strategy is one that's based on now a wide range of activities that can reach out to and draw in the broadest number of women possible, from rallies and demonstrations to petitioning and to briefs and to any number of the kinds of activities that the women's movement has come up with, but particularly that bring the utmost pressure and the most clearest demands to bear on the government so that they've got no room to inch out of their responsibilities and obligations to women of this country. Specifically, what we're doing in the Canadian Women's Coalition is we're calling a special conference in Toronto on March 16th to 18th, where women from across the country and internationally will be coming to speak out and protest against abortion laws, which are reactionary right around the world. And we feel this conference in itself will be a powerful and eloquent action calling on the government to act. We're investigating the possibilities of launching a legal case against the Canadian law, which would be similar to the U.S. Test case that came up. An important part of the work of the Canadian Women's Coalition will be the tribunal that the BC chapter is planning. They're going to be holding it here on February the 15th in the evening. I think that the tribunal in some ways sums up what we're talking about in the abortion repeal struggle, that too long Canadian women have suffered in silence from this law and other laws, and that those responsible for denying women the important right of controlling their bodies and their futures have gone unchallenged. And the tribunal will hear the sufferings of women under the present Canadian law and will indict those people who are responsible for this suffering on the part of women. I think it'll be a really powerful mark of how women are now speaking up and refusing to be silent and demanding their rights. We in the Canadian Women's Coalition think that this is the kind of strategy that can win. We feel that our sisters in the United States have helped us feel very good about this kind of a strategy. You know, it's interesting that abortion has been with us since the time of the dawn of so-called civilization. It's been a controversial issue in itself for at least 20 years. But it's only in the last few years when women have stood up and began to organize in seriousness, in large numbers, in visible protest activity, that things began to change. I think we're on the march now, that we've got justice and numbers on our side. We have a strategy that we feel can win, and we hope to join our United States sisters soon in our own victory. We feel very strongly that having control over our bodies is a very important step to gaining full control over our human lives. Okay.
Carol Singh. As I've been introduced, I'm coming from the sit-in or live-in is what it really is at the new Daycare Information Center, which is a provincial office. I want to talk about that and the events that have led up to it, which form its context. In the last few years particularly, many groups and individuals have been working for changes in the daycare structure and the system, which is largely controlled by government regulations. Women's groups, local community organizations, social agencies, daycare workers have all been working for more and better daycare. They've never formed one big voice, and they've never all shared the same visions of what more and better daycare should mean in BC or of how to implement it. And their strategies have differed. Some of us have used all the traditional strategies of writing briefs and gaining support and getting a lot of people to endorse the briefs and make them known by traveling to Victoria and giving our positions to the bureaucrats that control the offices that pertain to child care services. The occupation is a new strategy for daycare. The major issues regarding daycare, the major problems at least for the last couple of years, have been a seven that I've marked out. One is the need for quality group care for children under three. Another is 24-hour daycare. Another is the need for basic structural changes in the provincial government bureaucracy, which regulates and determines what kinds of daycare that we can legally set up. Four, more money for setting up centers, for operating centers. And five, changes in training which now stresses professionalism. Training for daycare workers is largely a two-year course that is academic mainly, and it's not that good in academic terms even. There's very little emphasis on on-the-job training or on choosing people that relate well to children. Another is a lack of information, just a total lack of information and a lot of difficulty in getting it. If you want to set up new daycare facilities, you're fighting the government just to find out what you can do and how you can get the little money that is offered. Now, the reasons that these have been the issues for so long, and they still are the issues, is that they haven't changed. The problems around them haven't changed at all, not even with the advent of our new people's government. And I'll retrace those. The first one, group care for kids under three in centers, has been treated as an illegality. That is, the only care that's officially regulated for children under three is family daycare. Family daycare is that care that's given in homes by the woman down the street. And there is a provincial subsidy that is given to parents who use family daycare facilities. There are so many problems with family daycare. For instance, the women who do it end up getting a very, very low wage. We did a study last year on 30 family daycare homes, and the average family daycare worker was making less than half of the minimum hourly wage in BC before that was raised. Most daycare, in fact, in BC is done by family daycare, and most family daycare is unlicensed, although it's supposed to be licensed. Family daycare workers are very isolated from each other, and parents have no real way of inspecting how their kids are cared for. Many family daycare homes have a TV, and that's what the kids do for most of the day, is watch TV. Some family daycare homes provide really good service, but there's no guarantee that you'll be getting it if you need care for your child under three. Group centers are only available to kids from 3 to 5. So this has been an issue that has been argued for a long time. Now, the professionals and the academics who teach the early child education course tend to say that for kids under three, the best possible daycare is which is given by family daycare homes. And the reasons, the grounds for this preference are absurd in a way, because they're theoretical, but they're not even, they're kind of misinterpretations of the theories that they're using and abusing. For instance, some of the people who run the Langara Center, in response to the question, you know, why can't we put our kids in group centers, will say that kids under three are just too egocentric and they can't play with groups of children. They have to relate basically to one adult figure, and that adult figure should be female. And you bring in more adults and you bring in more kids, and it really messes up the kid's socialization processes, which don't really start to happen until he's three. Somehow magically, she or he will begin to be socialized at three. And this is based on a Piaget description of egocentrism, which is not really it's much more complicated a concept than the way it's being taught in these watered down courses in child psychology and child development. But somehow it's being internalized by the workers and the professionals. Also, they bring to bear the studies on maternal deprivation. You can't put kids in group settings because that monkeys who have been deprived of their mothers get very depressed and they stop growing and developing intellectually, emotionally, and socially. And that kids in hospitals where there are 20 kids or 30 kids per one attendant tend to become retarded over a period of years. And these are the arguments used against group care for kids under three. Well, group care for kids under three doesn't have to be institutionalized in that sense, but it's always projected as some kind of horrible warehousey room where a bunch of kids are herded together and there's one attendant who's taking care of them and they have to fend for themselves and of course they're not going to develop socially. These are their best arguments and they're not good ones. The real basis, it seems, for government's protection of those ideas is that family daycare is very cheap for the province. And group daycare, especially for kids under three, is very expensive. Although the NDP before, the pre-election NDP, there's a difference, was saying that quality group care was one of its priorities in terms of daycare, Norm Levy has just made the statements that come out of the words of Goldie Maycock, who is the most powerful civil servant in the daycare structure and has even more power now than she had under the Socrates. He is now saying that group care for kids under three isn't a good idea. The only centers that exist in the province are not good ones. And that before we get into group care for kids under three, we've got to look at a lot of factors. So this is kind of putting off what was going to become a reality when the new government took office. The other analogy to that, is 24-hour daycare. Norm Levy himself was the Minister of Rehabilitation and Social Improvement, under which daycare, the daycare structure, mainly exists. It originated the term 24-hour daycare as an NDP platform in 1965, and he's been talking about it for years, right? He suddenly stopped talking about it because he's Minister of Welfare right now. And it is no longer a priority, he mentioned yesterday. These are frustrating things that have been happening as far as women who need daycare now are concerned. Another issue is the basic structural changes. Right now, as under the Socrates, there has been a bottleneck of power in the child care bureaucracy, and that used to be at 800 Cassiar Street in the provincial government offices. And it's called the Community Care Facilities Licensing Division. Child care is controlled by the licensing structure and as well as by the subsidy and the funding procedures. One civil servant who is the one consultant for the province and has been for the last 5 years has an office through which every possible aspect of child care development goes through for her approval. It is then rubber stamped in Victoria by the Community Care Facilities Licensing Board, and both under her and around her and above her, there's a lot of rubber stamps, but she basically is making the decisions. And this situation has not changed at all. The office at 800 Cassiar Street has been moved to 45 West 8th, where we are now sitting in. And that has been the most dramatic change that the NDP has made in terms of daycare. They brought the files, they brought the papers.
We got the files, we got the papers.
Okay. Okay, another issue has been, we want new policies on the role of the community regarding community services. The NDP has traditionally talked about community control of community services. Norman Levy meets with lots of people from the community, and he calls them consumers, and what they say he calls input, and then he makes decisions about what's going to happen, but they do not participate in the decision making regarding changes in child care. And people have been going to Victoria since the new government has come in and has been asking for the same things, and he's been turning around making statements saying, no, this is no longer a priority, this is not a priority, no matter how many people come in and ask him for those things. More money, that is one thing that's coming forth. There is more money, but it's minuscule, really. I mean, welfare plans to spend $2 million this year instead of $1 million last year on child care. Levy just okayed a budget of $10 million to be spent on certain specific juvenile delinquency programs. The lack of information, I've talked about that. It used to be that at 800 Cassiar, when you went to get information about licensing, you were grilled as to why you wanted it, who you were working for, what you were going to do with the information. This is public information. And then in the end, after you were interrogated for 5 minutes, they still wouldn't give it to you, and they'd say, write to Victoria. We've been working on a daycare information handbook. We cannot get information out of the government to give to the public, which is a service that the government should have been doing for years, because it puts the onus of development of child care services upon the public, and yet it refuses to assist them even with information about how those services are to be regulated. Until you set up a center, for instance, that may be a cooperative, and there is no legal supervisor who doesn't have the BC training. In that case, you get information from the government very quickly in the form of a letter from Gladys Maycock that says you can be fined $500 a day for your operation, and then a court order follows and you have to close down. That has been the SOCRED form of assistance to child care, and that basically has not changed. Now, the women who organize the occupation that's occurring at the daycare information office now, are a group of East End mothers, housewives, mothers, some of them are in welfare. They're not community organizers who did it. They're just people from the community who have been working for 8 months setting up 3 centers, which is fantastically fast. They're not licensed, of course, and they haven't been closed down yet, but they've been promised money and all sorts of aid. The reason they're so totally frustrated, and the occupation grew out of their frustration, is that with many meetings with Levy, they were promised things again and again, and the money was not forthcoming. They were told, after being told that they could have children under 3, when they enrolled 5 children under 3 in 1 center, they were told that their money would be cut off, the money that hadn't come yet anyway. This sort of hassle, which has been symptomatic of everybody's struggle who's tried to set up a daycare center in BC ever, is still going on, and it seems now really frightening in that a lot of those procedures are being formalized in a way that makes them more frozen than they were under the SOCRED government, in the sense that there's new rhetoric and it sounds like things are more liberal, but the same old civil servants are making the decisions and the same old cranky machinery is working as slowly as ever, and nobody seems to care, but promises are made and forgotten the next day. And these women have, without salaries, set up services that they desperately needed for themselves because nobody else was. And all they're asking for is the subsidy, and they're not getting it because of bureaucratic hang-ups. And they're asking for resource help and information help from the government. They're not getting it. And because of these things, they have been frustrated to the point where there's no other way that they can make any kind of impact on the public or on the government of their situation than to occupy the pseudo-information office that opened on the day that they moved in. And there's been growing support for these women from other groups of people who have struggled with the daycare situation. It would really be helpful in terms of this support. Like right now, the strategy has been to call for negotiations with Levy, Koch, and Daley, because there's still room, it's still up in the air, which department is going to take over the daycare structure. It's such a mess, but Levy has been making it his show so far. And however, these other ministries are involved, and we want to negotiate with all of them. And we want all the support we can possibly get. And we do have petitions that should be signed by everybody who's concerned about the issue of daycare, because it's everybody's battle. And if you don't have kids now, enroll, you know, a name in a daycare center if you want daycare, or sign our petitions too, because we need that and wires and letters to those three ministers, and money, if possible, for wires, not much. The office is at 45 West 8th, and we intend to stay until there's a neutral place that's assigned for these negotiations. And everybody's welcome all the time.
I'm speaking on behalf of the Working Women's Association. About this time last year, in a discussion about at this place, in this sort of format, I don't know how many of you recollect it, but Jean Rands spoke on behalf of the Working Women's Association. I am not going to repeat the statements that she made there, but they have since been printed in Women Unite, which is available at the back, and I would really strongly suggest that if any of you are at all interested in the kind of work that the Working Women's Association is doing, rereading, if you've read it before, rereading the article that Jean Rands wrote a year ago is a very good idea. It gives you an idea about how women fit into the economy and the potential of organizing working women and all that kind of stuff. But I'm not going to talk about that because I don't have much time. What I'm going to talk about is from then till now, right? Like the year since Jean was speaking, and you know, Jean's still in the same organization, but I was asked to speak this year. When Jean was speaking, at the end of it, somebody got up, I guess it was myself who got up and said, listen, the medieval inn people got fucked over, please don't go to the medieval inn to have dinner. So that thing went on. We picketed the medieval inn on Friday nights for a period of a couple of months, and then we stopped, okay? The women didn't get a union, the union was smashed, the union was a hotel restaurant employees union, but they did get a salary increase. Now, the boss didn't say that the salary increase was because of us, but they did get a fairly large chunk of the salary increase out of the whole thing. But more important than that, it began to establish the Working Women's Association as a part of the labor movement in the city. We publicized the boycott through all the labor papers in Vancouver, and that was one of the first times that they'd ever heard of the Working Women's Association, right? But they were respecting our picket line. And what happened was that for those of us in the Working Women's Association who were basically office workers and restaurant workers and stuff, who were also feminists and in the women's liberation movement, it established for us what the power of a picket line. Like, I don't know whether you all know what a picket line is, but what a picket line is, it says you don't cross it, no way. That's what it says. I mean, don't ask questions later, but first of all, you don't cross it. So that's the first thing that we did with the medieval inn. Second thing that was happening during the same period of time was, you may have heard about it, Smitty's Pancake House on Broadway and, I don't know, somewhere near Burrard, was organized. It was also written about the pedestal. The two women who organized Smitty's Pancake House are members of the Working Women's Association then and now. They organized into the Hotel Restaurant Employees Union, and once into the union, got no help whatsoever from the business agent, who never met with the women at all until after the women had gone down to the union office and voted to go on strike. The only people they had meetings with were Jackie and Elizabeth, the two women from the Working Women's Association who organized the place. And when the time came to vote on the contract proposal, the first contract proposal made by the company, the business agent told them that they had better sign that agreement because they weren't going to get nothing better. That same hotel restaurant union spoke at the minimum wage hearings held by the NDP after the election. They spoke against an increase in the minimum wage to $2 an hour. And the reason they gave for not increasing the minimum wage to $2 an hour was because that would put a lot of their union contracts below the minimum wage. So that was our experience with the Hotel Restaurant Employees Union. It's basically a bartender's union. The majority of its members are bartenders. Women are in a minority in that union. And absolutely, totally male-dominated and bureaucratic and controlled from the United States. One of the business agents from Hotel Restaurant ran as a social credit candidate. And what more than that, we were just looking through the BC Mediation Commission results from the last year, and Smitty's Pancake House is the only place that was organized by the Hotel Restaurant Employees Union in the last year. They had done absolutely no organizing of waitresses. Okay, that coming out of those two actions around spring, early summer, we learned a whole bunch about what trade unionism was. And what we learned enough to know that we know almost nothing about what trade unionism is, and that we have to know about what unions are before we tell women that they should organize into them. So we organized a series of seminars on unionism, which ran in early September. There were four seminars. They were held on Saturdays for a series of 4 weeks of Saturdays, and there were about 50 men and women came to them. The first one was on how to set up a union, what the procedures are, what the importance of what your constitution is and all that kind of stuff. The second was how do you negotiate a contract, both in terms of, well, kinds of things that would be useful to the daycare occupation forces, right? Like basic things, like you never agree to a company argument in front of the company. You know, you go outside and caucus. And you never disagree with somebody, a fellow union member in front of the boss, right? And things like that. Also, we had a discussion about the two of the central women's demands, one being equal pay for equal work and the other being daycare. The third was on striking, different kinds of strategies and tactics for strikes. And the fourth was on the shop steward structure. What is it? I don't know how many of you know what a shop steward structure is, but if you ever worked in a union shop, the shop steward is your local union representative. In fact, the shop steward structure is the most important structure in any trade union because the shop steward is on, you know, he ain't in any office. She's in, you know, she works with you. She does the same job as you. She gets the same pay as you, but she's a representative of the union. Anyway, all that stuff is going to be put into a booklet, which is just at the press now, and it'll be ready in a couple of weeks, and then you can buy it if you're interested. And that'll be the third in a series of booklets that the Working Women's Association has produced since we were here last year. The other two are women's work and working in hospital. The working in hospital is one, well, I mean, if you're in medicine or plan to be a nurse or anything like that, I would really suggest you read it because it gives you an idea of what hospitals are like. But it's pretty specific. It was done by way of supporting the women's caucus within the Hospital Employees Union. The other one is really a fun thing. It's reprints from Pedestal articles. Basically the story of five different working women, the kind of hassles they met on the job. And it's basically, it's a nice one, and it's sort of popular reading and stuff. The stories are about five different jobs: an office worker from UBC, a taxi cab driver, a temporary post office worker, and a waitress. On your chair, or not everybody's chair, every third or fourth person's chair, you'll find a Boycott Ward Air leaflet, which we've been recently distributing on behalf of the Canadian Airline flight attendants. If you're planning a trip to Honolulu in the next while, I would suggest that you don't fly Ward Air, or else a lot of your feminist friends will never speak to you again. That's basically, the reason why I gave out the leaflets was not because I thought you were gonna fly Ward Air, but because the fact that I seriously mean that if you went down and bought a Ward Air ticket after you came to this meeting and I told you about Ward Air, if you went down and bought a Ward Air ticket and flew to Honolulu, I wouldn't speak to you again. I mean, and you know, like the. Okay. Anyways, if you want to know about Ward Air, somebody can ask me in the question period. I mean, anyways, out of our experience with the international male-dominated bureaucratic unions, primarily the Hotel Restaurant Employees Union and the Office and Technical Employees Union, it became clear to us that office workers and waitresses need a union, so we are building one. Operating on the assumption that working women cannot wait for any government or any university or any American union to organize us, we must organize ourselves. On October 22, 1972, the Service Office and Retail Workers of Canada was founded by women who work in those industries. The objectives of SORWOC, I will read you some of the objectives of, or the objectives of SORWOC, which come from our Constitution. One, SORWOC believes that every woman who works should earn enough money to provide a decent living for herself, himself, and her family. The union will bargain collectively on behalf of its members to bring about fair wage standards, to reduce the difference between the lowest and the highest rates, to assure equal pay for comparable work for all, regardless of sex, age, marital status, race, religion, or national origin. The union will strive to improve working conditions of members, to maximize the opportunities for personal fulfillment in the work situation of all members, and to reduce working hours and to eliminate any overtime. The union will work to ensure job security for all members and to end discrimination in hiring and promotion. Within the community, the union will work for the establishment of political and social equality, for free parent-controlled child care centers. We just sent a check for $25 to the daycare occupation forces to put in real form that commitment. For community control of schools, for community health services, against price and rent increases, which erode the gains made through collective bargaining. The union will encourage unionization of unorganized workers and will charter local unions, maintaining at all times the principles of local autonomy and democracy within the national union and its local constitution. A cigarette. We will also maybe stop smokers. That'll take a while. I have a copy of the constitution of the union here, which anybody can look at afterwards. Basically, our constitution ensures democracy, local autonomy, that is controlled by the union members, and it serves as a model by which women workers who are in other unions, like if you're in some other union, you can compare our constitution with the constitution of your union, and it'll give you a good way by which you can analyze the problems and the problems within your union, because every union has a constitution, and it's very important to look at that constitution, because it tells you who has the power, and it tells you what your rights are and what your responsibilities are as a trade unionist. by way of quoting, I'll quote one section of the Constitution which gives you an idea what kind of union we want to become. Section 7B of Sarawak's Constitution reads, "There shall be no full-time paid employees of the union unless proposed by a convention and approved by the national union membership in a referendum." And from 7C, "Nominations for full-time paid positions will not be accepted by the convention for any member completing her, his second consecutive term of office." What that means is that no time ever can anybody be an employee of Sarawak for more than 2 years. If you've been, you know, like, we don't have any full-time staff now because we're all unorganized working women and we can't have any staff. But I mean, at some point in the future, when we've got all the offices in Vancouver and all the waitresses in Vancouver in our union, we have it insured. That provision of the Constitution can never be changed. No one will ever be an employee of Sarawak for more than 2 years without returning to the job and working as a waitress or working as an office worker. That ensures in the Constitution that no paid bureaucracy can ever develop within the union. But that's enough about that stuff. You can come by the Working Women's Association office, which is at number 345 Kingsway, anytime between 12 and 5. It's staffed every day. Or read about what we're doing through The Pedestal, which is a women's liberation newspaper in Vancouver, or The Grape, which is a labor paper in Vancouver. And the fact that you can read about it through The Pedestal and The Grape gives you kind of an idea of the kind of organization the Working Women's Association is. In some ways, we are in the women's movement and we are in the labor movement, yet somehow we're distinct from both the women's movement and the labor movement. I'd like to end by saying something about you, not us. I'm not trying to say that you should join the Working Women's Association. I trust that you're at Women's Studies because of a growing outrage at what this male-dominated, American-controlled society has done to you. If you work, but what I am saying is that if you work, or if after you finish school, you get a job in a shitty, low-paying place, and when that happens, what you should do is talk with the women you work with about your anger. But more than that, listen to their anger, because the other women you work with are just as angry as you. And don't let Nixon and Trudeau and Barrett and your boss divide you from the other women that you're working with. Because all of them are doing it every day. They're dividing us, they're splitting us apart, they're making divisions between us. And I mean, I can think of 10 zillion thousand ways in which I'm different from everybody in this room, because I'm me and you're you, right? And if you have anger inside yourself at the male-dominated American union bureaucrats, don't let that anger make you anti-union. Unionism is the solidarity of women on strike or in an occupation like the daycare occupation. It's the only power that we have. It's the potential of the statement, "Sisterhood is powerful," which most of us already believe. That means to those of you who are at UBC as staff, students, and faculty, is building the Association of University and College Employees, a union founded by women who are clerical workers, secretaries, and typists, and library clerks, the non-professional staff who work at this place. The Status of Women of UBC booklet, which a lot of you have probably seen, is very similar, we feel, to the Status of Women, the Royal Commission and the Status of Women report. It has the same advantages and the same limitations as the Royal Commission report on the Status of Women. It documents the situation of women at UBC, but like the Royal Commission report, it doesn't say anything about what you're supposed to do about it. On page 51, for instance, of this booklet, it says, "Union or not," and then proceeds to describe the problem, the differences in wages between men and women workers, unionized and ununionized at UBC. But the thing is that that's OTU, which is an American union, which is in the AFL-CIO, who put campaign funds into Richard Nixon's political campaign in the last election. That's what American unions did. They supported Richard Nixon in the last election. But what happens is people get angry at American unions, and then they become anti-union, right? I guess that's about all, except that the phone number. If you want to join the Association of University and College Employees, you can contact Jennifer Clemens at 988-7539. If you're a faculty or a student, if you're a faculty or a student at UBC, or if you're a non-student who hangs around up here, what I would suggest is the next time you're in your department, you say to the secretary in that department, what do you think about unionizing? And you just speak to them, right? I mean, you people are all students who are in women's liberation, right? So you just go in and talk to the secretary who you probably know. You probably know some people who work at UBC. I'm sure all of you do. Just talk to them about the union. They have 300 people now, they need 600. And, you people have a responsibility as women's liberationists. I don't, I'm not working on campus, but people who are on campus have a responsibility to help build the union. And, the people who are building the union can only build the union on their lunch hours between 12 and 1, and it's real hard, because they all work here. And they don't have any paid staff, and so why don't you go talk to them? That's all.
Okay, I'll now take questions.